They gave him his orders at Monroe, Virginia. Said, Steve, you're way behind time. This is not 38, this is old 97. You must put her into Spencer on time. He turned around and said to his black crazy fireman, shovel on a little more coal. And when we cross that white oak mountain, watch old 97 roll.
It's about control in the workplace and also being treated with dignity and respect. And, you know, when we go to work, we don't stop being human beings. We still want to have control over our lives.
Alex Wood is the author of Despotism on Demand, How Power Operates in the Flexible Workplace. I caught up with him recently to discuss the history of relationships between bosses and workers and how that's playing out in the age of COVID-19. And on this week's Labor History in 2, Rick Smith tells us about the wreck of the old 97. I'm Chris Garlock, and that's all ahead on this week's Labor History Today. I hope you enjoy the show.
So now all you pretty ladies, you better take a warning from this time on and learn. Don't you speak hard words to your true lover husband, he may leave you and never return.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1903. That was the day that is remembered in Virginia as the wreck of Old 97. Old 97, also known as the Fast Mail, was a Southern Railway freight train. It carried the U.S. mail from Washington, D.C. to Atlanta, Georgia. The train wreck happened on the leg of the trip from Monroe, Virginia to Spencer, North Carolina. The train had come in late to Monroe. It was reported that the railway company ordered the engineer to increase the speed of the train to make up time. The company had to pay a penalty if they delivered the mail late. But when the train neared Danville, Virginia, the tracks curved at the Stillhouse Trestle Bridge. The speed was simply too much. Despite the engineer's efforts to slow the train, it careened off the tracks and plummeted to the rocky ravine 45 feet below. 11 of the 16 people on board the train died, including the conductor, the engineer, and the flagmen and both firemen. The railway company blamed the wreck on the deceased engineer. Newspapers across the country carried photos of the wreck. The disaster became the subject of multiple ballads. One version, by Vernon Dalhart in 1924, is thought to be the first million-selling country record in U.S. history. Johnny Cash recorded another well-known version of the song. In 1993, an alternative country band took the name the Old 97s, hearkening back to the disaster and the songs it inspired.
They gave him his orders at Monroe, Virginia. Said, Steve, you're way behind time. This is not 38, this is old 97. You must put her into Spencer on time.
For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Alex Wood is a sociologist of work and employment, focusing on the changing nature of employment relations and labor markets. His new book is Despotism on Demand, How Power Operates in the Flexible Workplace. Previous publications include Good Gig, Bad Gig, Autonomy and Algorithmic Control in the Global Gig Economy, and Networked but Commodified, The Disembeddedness of Digital Labor in the Gig Economy. Alex is a lecturer in the Sociology of Work at the University of Birmingham and a research associate at the Oxford Internet Institute at the University of Oxford. Ed Smith and I talked with Alex on the Your Rights at Work show recently, which airs Thursdays from 1 to 2 p.m. on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C.
I want to start off with a quote. I just pulled off the National Nurse United Twitter feed. This is from a nurse named Juanetta Jemison at the Tuscaloosa, that's in Alabama, the Tuscaloosa VA Medical Center. This is literally today's Twitter. And she said, we have had nurses who have tested positive for COVID-19 being told by hospital management that they need to return to work or they will be disciplined, even though those nurses have tested positive for the virus. Now, Alex, this seemed to me to resonate with some of the arguments that you make in your book, Despotism on Demand. Am I way off on that, or does that resonate for you as well?
What the book is all about is how kind of power relations in the workplace, in US capitalism and also UK capitalism, how they've transformed over time. And so, you know, in the bad old days of early capitalism, employers used to manage their workforce through using the stick, so using kind of similar threats to what you just described there, but threatening workers with fines, with dismissals, putting people on blacklists if they tried to join a union, and even particularly in the US, using violence in order to repress kind of the labor movement. But then in kind of the early 20th century, we started to have kind of assembly lines, which gave workers much more power. You had the development of monopoly capitalism and higher profits, and you got kind of real compromises, and employers started to use kind of legitimization, incorporating worker or organization, giving workers a voice within the firm. And you got kind of improvements in working conditions, real improvements for workers. Workers had a voice. But in the 1970s, that all collapsed, that broke down, and you had this move towards kind of hostility. And the book is all about kind of how the managers control their workforces now that this kind of compromise has broken down. And kind of I focus particularly on the way in which managers threaten workers with around working time. So shifting people's hours about if they don't perform well, or if they go join a union, if they go to a pro-labor protest, how they cut their hours. And then it tries to look at how workers can have new forms of power to kind of create a new kind of compromise or win power back from employers.
Now, Alex, you embedded, you know, actually worked as a checkout clerk over there in the UK. And then you also spent some time over here in the US, both times, I think, with supermarket workers, right?
Yeah. So two of the biggest supermarkets in kind of the UK and in the US. And so I spent about 2 years doing the field work. And so I spent about a year with UK union organizers, going to branch meetings, going to stores, and then working as I was actually a shelf stacker. So I was on an 8-hour contract, and I was kind of would go in for 2 hours a day. And at the drop of the hat, a manager would say, we need you to stay longer, or they'd ring me up in the morning and say, we need you to come in earlier. And so it just created this scheduling nightmare. You know, never knew what hours you were going to work, but you needed more hours to be able to survive. Otherwise, you know, you couldn't make ends meet. And then I went over to the US, where there was kind of a labor-backed mobilization to try and improve working conditions. And in the US, I followed kind of union organizers around. I also participated in a bit of kind of union organizing, talking to workers who were a bit surprised by this English guy who kind of why came over to talk to them and interview them. And it was exactly the same, and perhaps even worse, that, you know, workers were saying how they couldn't plan their childcare, they couldn't have a social life, they couldn't play baseball. If their managers found out that they'd joined this worker organization backed by the union, their hours would be shut, would be cut. And really, it was just shocking how these very different kind of climates in the UK and the US, the similar suffering that people really experience on a daily basis, having to make this decision, should I leave my child without childcare because I'm being told to come into work, or should I look after my children, but then I can't afford to feed them?
Alex, what I'm wondering is, know, this control of workers is something that we've really seen during the pandemic. Your book really takes it from Marx right on up through a lot of how this came to be. But what I was really fascinated with is something that we've been seeing over the, you know, recent months. And we've had folks on the show. I've interviewed some of the different unions. And Ed is from the nurses union. We've had folks on, in fact, just last week from the supermarket workers. A lot of these folks, the so-called essential workers, they're the ones that have been really fighting over, it takes the form of fighting over safety, but it seems to me it's really the same issue as what you're talking about. It really has to do with control in the workplace.
Yeah, exactly. It's about control in the workplace and also being treated with dignity and respect. And, you know, when we go to work, we don't stop being human beings. We still want to have control over our lives. Right. And the ultimate one is control over our safety. We don't want to be forced to go into a working environment where we could die or we could pass on a really infectious disease to our loved ones and be economically coerced into that, be coerced into it by threats that if you don't come into work, you'll lose your job. Or in the case of what I look at in the book, you'll lose your hours or your hours will be shifted around so you can't provide your childcare anymore. And so, yeah, I think it all comes down to who has power, who has control in the workplace, but also why do we work? We work in order to live, and therefore work should be an experience which enables us to reach our human capabilities. And, you know, we believe in democracy, and so you should have a voice in your workplace as well. And so I think this is the problem. And then the book tries to look at how workers, such as the ones you're talking about and the Eds involved in, that new ways to try and organize and try and gain a voice and dignity in the workplace again. Because I think, particularly in the US, where there's so much employer hostility towards organized unions, there's so few institutional supports, then unions really need to do things in kind of new ways. Kind of use direct action, use social media, use WhatsApp, use new technologies, as well as kind of the traditions, bringing back the traditions from the CIO of kind of workplace organizing.
We're talking with Alex Wood. He's the author of Despotism on Demand, How Power Operates in the Flexible Workplace. I'm Chris Garlick. Also, of course, Ed Smith.
Yeah, I have a comment. One of the things very interesting, what you were just talking about, workplace work schedules, one of the things that's happened in healthcare industry is back in the day, the unions pushed the ability to work different schedules, 8-hour schedules, 10-hour schedules, 12-hour schedules, and the unions fought for options. Now the tide has turned a little bit. A lot of management, a lot of employers are now changing people's work schedules from either a 5-day, 8-hour a day schedule to 3 12-hour, which ultimately cuts their amount of hours from 40 to, and obviously, as you talked about, daycare issues and all things like that. And it's difficult to combat. I guess even in a union environment, it's difficult to combat. I don't know if you want to comment on that. I'm not, or if you were aware that that's what's happening in the healthcare industry as well.
Yeah, and so the UK case study that I looked at, there was actually a union, and they did provide a lot of benefits to their workers around disciplinaries, but around scheduling, where it's central to the profit margins of the company, because the company wants to restrict their labour supply to match really closely with customer demand, and the way to do that is to put people on these short hours that you're talking about, and then you can just flex them up and force them to come in. It didn't have any influence. And I think that's the problem, is that you can have institutions such as unions in place or works councils in Germany. But if labor doesn't have sufficient bargaining power, if employers don't actually think they need to listen to that worker voice, then it's not going to have a big impact. And so we need unions, but we also need ways for unions to have more power, I think. And I think when we look in Europe, the only places where unions, where we have better job quality is in Scandinavia, where you have very high collective bargaining rights and you have laws for co-determination with unions. And so, yeah, I think it's completely, unions need more power as well. Labor doesn't have enough power generally. And probably one of the things that makes me most mad is when people talk about flexibility and they talk about it as a positive thing for everybody, because exactly how you said it, it's if your manager is in control of that flexibility, it's not flexibility, it's precarity. It's a nightmare for you. If you're like me and you're an academic and you have control of that flexibility, then it's a great thing. And so it's also a source of inequality, a new source of inequality in the workplace. And yeah, it frustrates me so much when it's just taken as a positive kind of automatically, when it's all about control, who has control of that flexibility.
You know, it occurs to me, Alex,
that's a great point.
No, just that you, go ahead, Chris. Given that you've been studying this, you know, deeply, you know, I always sort of wonder, you know, trying to put myself in a boss's shoes, you know, they want folks, you know, like say to be flexible, but you know, if everybody is just sort of getting plugged in a few hours here and a few hours there, or their hours cut abruptly or being called in, as you were saying, being called in abruptly, it just doesn't seem like you're going to get, you know, good workers consistently, you know, for the long term. And you always hear, if you read any management, you know, news, you know, they're always complaining about, you know, workers don't have loyalty and that, you know, well, how do you expect folks to have loyalty? It's a two-way street, right?
Yeah, I think there's a recent study done in the US, actually. I think it was Gap. And they actually gave people better schedules, gave them kind of control over their schedules, and it increased productivity, it increased profits because people were doing a better service, people were happy. But this is kind of another fiction, is that managers, you know, necessarily know how best to manage a workplace rather than them following kind of logics and like short-term aims, and they're put under pressure to reduce their labor costs, and kind of CEOs of firms have to increase their profit margins by their shareholders. And so, yeah, I think the problem is more systemic, and we need systemic change. And for me, that is creating institutions and finding new ways to give labor more of a voice, because, you know, that's the strength of that's why unions are beneficial for capitalism, is that they provide an independent voice to workers, which then can lead to better management decisions, because managers aren't just talking to themselves, aren't just workers, you know, don't have a voice, can't say this isn't a good idea or I'm really unhappy with this because they're afraid of losing their job.
You had a question? Go ahead.
Well, a comment. Two of my least favorite words in dealing with labor negotiations or labor management relations are flexibility and loyalty. because flexibility is a one-way street, as far as I've learned over 30 years. It's always management wants to cut some contract language and working conditions, or get rid of some language and working conditions so that they can be more flexible. And then loyalty. You know, I've never seen a company have any loyalty towards people. Maybe a little bit here and there, but in the end, you're a cog in the wheel. And we are all expendable. Even those of us that work for labor unions, we are expendable. And so to talk to me about loyalty and flexibility, I don't want to hear it. I will tell you something that we did in current negotiations that I plan to use more, and I learned this through basically Zoom and coronavirus. I can't go into my units at hospitals. I could, but I've had a video recording, short little 45-second videos saying, this is why I support the union in this proposal. And you can get 15, 20 nurses to do this and then edit it down into a nice 6-7 minute piece and show it to management. So rather than actually have a physical job action, you're having a video job action. And I don't know how successful it will be, but it's something I'll be doing more in the future. So that enables employees to recognize they can have power. It doesn't take a walkout. It is a minor form that he's really willing to stand for. I don't know if you want to comment on that or whether I'm just coming out of left field, Alex.
Yeah, well, I think that sort of experimentation and using new technologies in new ways is crucial. Kind of the thing I just say to end with is that I think this crisis, but also climate change, it shows that we need radical change. And so we need to be thinking about how we can kind of, yeah, transform our society so that we have been working to live, so that we have kind of a voice and democracy in our workplaces. And this is kind of a great opportunity to right this suffering that many people have even before the crisis, and which is only being kind of amplified by this crisis and further by the climate crisis, even will be even worse.
They gave him his orders at Monroe, Virginia. Said, Steve, you're way behind time. This is not 38.
That's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe to LHT on your favorite podcast app. And even better, you can like it in your podcast app and pass it along. You too can be part of the Labor History Today team by reading a labor history item. Just shoot us a note. laborhistorytoday@gmail.com. Today's music is The Wreck of the Old 97 by, of course, Johnny Cash. Labor History Today is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, working people's voices, broadcasting worldwide 24 hours a day. You can find out more at laborradionetwork.org, where there are links to more than 70 labor radio and podcast shows. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Evan Papp, Jessica Pozak, and Alan Weirdak. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and healthy, but do keep making history, and see you next time.
So now, all you pretty ladies, you better take a warning from this time on and learn. Don't you speak hard words to your true lover husband. He may leave you and never return.